Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Guy Dunlap of Guy's Woodshop, and I'm joined by Hui Huynh of the Alabama Woodworker.
Hello, how are you doing, Guy?
I am awesome. And also Sean Walker of Simple Cove.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Doing great.
Good. This podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community, and we really want to give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops, right, wrong, or otherwise. It's just how we do things. So since this is our first show with questions, we really don't have any questions from the audience per se. So what all three of us did is we went back in our archives. We're all pretty prolific on both YouTube and Instagram. And we went back and got some questions that we thought would be good for you guys to hear the answers to and we could have a discussion on. Does that sound good for you guys?
Sounds great.
Yeah. And Google Plus, potentially.
And Google Plus. Does anybody still use it?
Yeah, I know.
Diami Plotki.
Yeah.
We love you, Diami. So let's get right into it. So Hui has been designated for the first question. So what do you got for us, buddy?
All right, so I've got a chisel question. I had a gentleman contact me, and he had just bought some new Narex chisels, great value chisels, and he was asking what he needed to do to prepare the backs of the chisels, and he had gotten some conflicting things told to him, where he was told that he had to flatten the entire back of the chisel. While that's a good idea, and it's not a bad idea to do, it might be actually a little bit of a waste of time.
You got to flatten the back first, man.
You do have to flatten the back. One thing that I don't think you need to do is I don't think you need to flatten it all the way back. I think maybe about a half an inch is good to flatten. You could maybe even do a little less than that, but I think a half an inch is a good amount. Most modern manufacturing is going to result, if you're getting a decent chisel, in a little bit of a concavity on the back of the chisel. Unless it's being machined and it's a premium chisel, for example, if it's a Lee Nielsen or a Lee Valley, that back, the entire back of that chisel is likely to be flat because they're doing machining afterwards. But if it's a modern chisel through modern manufacturing that's either midline or even budget line, you're going to get a little bit of concavity on the back, and it's good to flatten the back, but you don't have to flatten it all the way to the bolster of the chisel.
You're just trying to get it so you can put a sharp edge on it.
Exactly.
And a reference surface.
Now, Guy, what are you using to flatten the backs of your chisels or plane irons for that matter?
I use Shapton glass stones.
Big time.
Yeah. it was when I had, you know, a couple extra bucks in my pocket, which I don't anymore when I had a full-time job. So I have a 400 grit diamond stone that I use when I first get a chisel flat in the back and to get the initial bevel on it. And then I work up from there. But it's just like anything else. I mean, once you get it sharp, which can't, you know, especially a new chisel, and I have some Narex chisels, and they took a lot to get sharp initially. It was not a lot of fun. But once I got them sharp, it only takes 5 minutes, less than that, to sharpen them now, because you're just, you know, polishing that bevel you've already put on it.
Right, right.
So it's
removing the burr from the back.
Sean, what do you use to sharpen and to flatten?
I've got a Shapton Waterstones 1000, 5000, 8000 for flattening those, and for flattening the Waterstones, and for touching up new chisels and plane irons. I have a coarse DMT plate that I use that I'll start with. That I believe it is a 400, like Guy's. I'll start there and then work my way up from there. But on chisels, I have the Ashley Isles, and they're relatively short to begin with. It's not like I forgot what they're called. They're the bench chisels. Maybe they're the pattern chisels. I'd have to look, but they were the shorter Ashley Isles chisels. Mm-hmm. So they're not, they're probably 3 inches in length anyways. So, I think I've flattened them about the first inch, up the back of the blade,
yeah,
or the chisel rather, and then stop there. on that.
Yeah, I also have the Narex chisels just like Guy, and it did take a little bit of time. Well, not a little bit. It took quite a bit of time to flatten the back because it had quite the concave back, especially the 1-inch or 1 1/4-inch chisel. But man, those things, they keep a pretty good edge once you get that back flattened and polished. And for me, I use a coarse DMT stone or DMT diamond plate. Actually, for all my sharpening, I use DMT diamond plates. And I believe what I have is 1,000, 3,000, 8,000 is what the equivalent is. And then my coarse is somewhere around like 320 or 400. One thing that I've definitely noticed about using diamond is that, man, it removes material pretty fast. And if you're not careful, you can actually remove a lot more than needs to be. Is that the case with Chapton or with Waterstones? Because I've not used
the Chapton glass. They're aggressive, but not as aggressive as a diamond plate. I guess I could have bought diamond plates for about the same price I paid for those Chapton glass stones, because they're like about $100 to $150 a piece. And I think I have four of them. So it was a substantial investment. But, you know, the thing with sharpening is everybody's got a different way of doing it. And the most important thing is that you find a way that works for you and
stick with it.
You know, but yeah. Going back to the original question, you do not need to flatten the entire back.
Maybe a half an inch is a reasonable amount that you can go back and should give you plenty of life. And as you're chasing that burr, you're receding that flattened back anyway.
Yeah.
Sean, you had something to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I do like to live dangerously, and what I will often do when I get a new chisel is I will swipe it across the diamond plate a few times, the full back, just to get an idea of the whole length of the chisel, and just to get a general idea of if I'm going to run into problems later, how flat is it? Yeah, I typically only do the first inch or so. But my question for you was, did you explain your setup? Are you all diamonds? And what do you use to lubricate your diamonds when you're sharpening?
I just use Simple Green. I do know some people have used Windex. Some folks just use water. I tend not to use water. And the reason why I don't like to use water is because sometimes the water, while that won't oxidize the diamond plate, sometimes you'll get shavings or swarth on the diamond plate. And that has metal filings in it. And it'll discolor it and kind of get it sort of all brown and nasty looking. So I tend to just use Simple Green.
I'm guilty of that. Mine looks like that now. Sorry.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm all diamond plates. Yeah, I use all diamond plates. But cool. One of these days I'd like to get some Chapton glass, but that'll be later. Right now it works for me.
Yeah,
so
yeah, if it's working for you. So Sean, we're going to go over to you. What do you have for us?
All right, let's shift gears and let's talk router tables, and specifically the starter pin. What is it, when, and why would you use it? I had this question asked because I posted a couple of Instagram videos talking about using the starter pin to help guide the piece into the bit, just to make it safer. But if you're unfamiliar with it, it's typically a half-inch round metal pin that's roughly about an inch long. And on one end of the pin, it'll have a 1/4-20 threading that you can screw into your router table. A good majority of the router tables, if not all of them, have holes on both sides of the bit that you can install a starter pin. So you can put it on the left or the right, or sometimes you can use it both of them at the same time, obviously. And I'm using it for curved surfaces when you can't use the fence to help ease your piece into the bit. You're going to use a starter pin. So you'll screw it into the table, and then you'll pivot your workpiece into the router bit. If you try to push your piece without a fence or a starter pin, the bit can catch the piece and, of course, push it around, and it makes it a little unsafe. So I often use my starter pin anytime that I can't use my fence that I'm using a bit. So for instance, on my bar stools I'm currently building, I've got an MDF template for every piece that I'm using pretty much for the whole bar stool. I had them cut on a CNC machine. So what I would do is cut the cherry to rough size, double tape the template on it, and then use a flush trim bit to take it down to the exact size. And a lot of these pieces are curved, so I can't use my fence to safely push it into the bit. So I will move the fence out of the way, put the starter pin in, and then pivot off of the starter pin into the bit just to get it started. Now, oftentimes when I get the cut started, I will move away from the starter pin just a little bit because they're curved, obviously, and the starter pin could potentially get in the way. So that's pretty much when and why I use a starter pin. Now, for starter, you will typically use a starter pin for bits with bearings on the top, like a rabbiting bit or a flush trim bit, when you can't use your fence. But though that's pretty much the lowdown on starter pins, and I know that you guys probably obviously use starter pins quite a bit. Because Guy, I know you
actually
do a lot of pattern.
I don't
load.
Use the starter pin as much as I should.
Agreed. I don't use it as much as I should. But no, you're dead on, Sean, in terms of being safe, particularly with a lot of curved work. It's generally a good idea. I just don't.
I don't
want
to derail the question by going off on a tangent. You said your pattern routing. What kind of bit are you using for pattern routing? Are you using just a regular straight bit?
I have.
Or is it a compression?
No, I dropped quite a bit of coin on a half inch by 2 inch upcut spiral flush trim bit. Yeah, I think it's a white side. It was really expensive. It's like $94, $95 on Amazon. But, I mean, it just does a fantastic job.
Is it compression? Is that no, it's upcut, right?
No. Yeah. It's not the CMT or whatever compression bits. It's the actual spiral upcut.
Yeah, the compression bit I have is from Whiteside.
Yeah, that's a pretty penny too, though,
about
isn't
$150. I got that when they had, every now and then, Woodcraft run specials where it's like 25% off on everything in the store, with, of course, exception of Festool lead jigs and some other stuff. That's when I bought it.
To be honest with you, the router table freaks me out. It's the one tool in the shop that I'm just not a fan of. I love what it can do for you. But anytime that I make a cut, I check everything, make sure the bit's nice and tight, and make sure the fence is in place, or I use a starter pin and I use push pads. And that's just one tool that just freaks me out that I do not like.
The router table. The router table is probably the second most used tool in my shop, the bandsaw being number one.
Yeah, when it comes to curvilinear work, using that pattern routing bit in the router table is and template work is a must.
Yeah, but even just doing simple stuff like cutting rabbets and dados and grooves, I can set if the cut isn't too deep. So if you're trying to go an inch into some 12-quarter wood, the router table probably isn't the right tool because you have to do it in like 5 or 6 passes. And you can do that with one pass with the dado stack. But I'd much rather just, if I got like a quarter inch deep groove that I have to make, I'm going router table every time, man. Because I can set that thing up in like 2 minutes. I got a lift. I got the Incra fence on there. And I've been using an Incra fence on my router table for over 20 years. So I'm very familiar with it. And I can just boom, boom, boom. And I'm ready to rock and roll. To do that, to set up a dado stack to do that, it takes a lot of time. Not a lot of time. It may take, 5, 10 minutes.
Guy, I'm the same way. I love having a dado stack. That's for sure. And I think it's a definite must if you're doing a lot of cabinet joinery. But having that router table, man, and I too have an Incra fence, and it's an old Incra fence. It is actually 20 years old. But man, when you get that dialed in, it's so simple.
You have the old twin linear?
No, actually, I have the one that came after that. I believe I have the Incra Ultra.
Okay, that's not 20 years old.
Maybe it's 14. You're the one that would know that answer, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I went from twin linear to the one I have now. Actually, I've got mine on Craigslist. I bought it for, it's the big 25 inch one, the current one. I think I paid like $150 for it.
Nice. I got mine from Craigslist as well.
Now you have an Incra fence on yours, don't you, Sean? It's like the Woodcraft version of it.
Yeah, it was the Pinnacle brand knockoff. It works, I guess. It's not amazing, but it works, holds its settings. But, that's okay. One thing I wanted to ask you real quick, and then we'll move on, is what router you guys have in your router tables? Because, you know, I've had a 2.25 Bosch in my router table for the past 5 years. And what are you guys sporting in your router tables?
I have a 3.25 horsepower Porter cable, whatever model that is, that's real ubiquitous. Everybody's got it. Yeah.
This 7518 or something like that?
It's something like that.
I have the same one that Guy has, Sean. And yeah, I think you're right. I think it's the 7518.
Aha, got it right.
I bought it as an open box item through Amazon. Before that, I had a Bosch. I think I had your router in the router table, which is a Bosch 1617. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, I had that before, and it worked well. Didn't really have complaints, but I really wanted to spin the bigger bits for Cope and Stick joinery, Cope and Stick frame and panel doors, yeah, and whatnot.
I've got some big so panel just, raising bits that are like, you know, 2.25 inches, 3 inches wide, and they're big and heavy. You got to slow it down. You need a lot of torque to spin that bad boy.
Well, Guy, that's my question. Right. What do you have for us?
I'm going to go back a while in through my YouTube channel. I did a video a long time ago on how to get a board straight and flat, or S4S, which is surfaced four sides. One of the things I explained in there was grain direction, and I put the board through the thickness planer and I flipped it end for end and put it back through. So the question from Matthew on this was, I understand the grain directions, but why would you flip the board when working it down in thickness? Would you not want to keep the same reference surface for each pass, or does it not matter? Or are you just trying to take it evenly from both sides? I mentioned before flipping the board. So let's say you've got a board and the cathedrals are pointing away from you. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the way the grain direction is going. You kind of have to look at the side of the board and kind of figure the way it's going. So let's say in this case, from where you're standing right now, the cathedral's pointing away from you. The grain is going from the back edge of the board to the front edge of the board. When you put that through the thickness plate, you actually want to spin it around the other way, so the grain is facing you or going towards you as you feed it in, if that makes sense, because you're not cutting against the grain. There's going to be less tear out and chips and things like that. Now, when the board goes through, if all you did was, and we'll talk about why I flip it in a minute, but if you just flip that side to side instead of end for end, just like across its width, you're actually, when you push it through, now the grain is going the other way, and you're actually going to push it through against the grain. So when you flip it end for end, you're keeping the grain direction going the right way. Number one. Number two, as part of the question is, you know, why would you want to keep flipping the board? Why don't you just use your same reference and then just work it down from there? You can do it that way. However, wood absorbs moisture. We all know that. It's basically just straws all packed together very tightly. And it's going to retain water, and the center of it is going to retain more water than the outside of it. So if you just start, let's say you've got a 5/4 board that you're trying to get down to about 7/8. Well, you're taking quite a bit. You know, it's almost 3/8 of an inch of wood. If you took that all off of one side, you'd be getting into the very wet part of the wood while the other side of the board is still fairly dry. And you set that down in your shop, you'll come back the next day and it's going to be cupped. Going that route of going the one way, flipping it over, going the other way, and trying to take an even amount off the top and bottom of the board, or your reference face and the non-reference face, which is actually going to become your reference face. It's all working the same way with you. There's less chance of that board cupping. They're still going to cup, but you're just going to help mitigate that.
I've got a question for you, Guy. If let's say you were dealing with quarter sawn material, are you going to see more or less that same type of phenomenon, or is that maybe more prevalent with flat sawn material?
It's more prevalent with flat sawn material. As far as the moisture content or the grain direction.
Quartosan,
well, yeah, quartosan, the grain direction on both the top and bottom should be pretty darn close to the same thing. So that's not a big issue. The issue still is always, from what I was told, now I don't know if that's true or not, but that, but when you think about it, it makes sense. You're just taking an even amount off of each side to help compensate for the moisture. I would think that would ring true on any board that you're thickest.
You know, I don't flip end for end after every iteration through the planer, but I definitely do flip just because, again, it seems like that would be the case, that if you're taking all the material off of one side, that that there's just an unevenness in terms of the moisture that you're extracting from the wood.
Now, do you have helical head on your thickness planer, Hui?
I do.
See, I don't care about grain direction anymore.
I was going to say, you guys, it's not fair.
Well, even when I did that video, I had the little DeWalt four post, and that had a helical head in it. And I did that strictly for the video because not everybody has it.
You had that four post DeWalt planer for a long time,
about
didn't you?
3 years. You know, before that, I had just a regular DeWalt lunchbox planer. I mean, I ran a business with that thing. It was fine. I've never had maybe like two or three times in my life, I've come across a board that was wider than 12 inches. Everything I'm buying, man, it's all, you know, 6 to 10 inches wide. Anything I get from the lumber yard, and 12 inches is more than enough. When I upgraded to that, the main reason I upgraded to it, because I wanted to get the helical head. And it was a really good machine. The only problem with it was, if I had a lot of material, let's say I was, you know, at a project where I was going to use 50, 60, 70 board feet of lumber, and I'm feeding it through that thing, it would overheat and shut down.
I had a similar problem. I had the DeWalt 734 was the one before that four post, and it would also shut down.
And it was just infuriating. And I can only take, because the helical head and it's a universal motor, you know, it's all those blade slapping against the wood, I could only take a 32nd of an inch off at a time. So you're trying to take a quarter inch off of, you know, 10 boards, you're going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Good luck. Yeah. You might as well go ahead and bring your lunch.
Another thing I do too is if I start a project, I go ahead and pick out all the wood and I lay it out and I pull all the parts from it and I give everything an initial milling. And all I do is get it flat and square. And then I actually store my wood not stickered, but I stand it on edge on sawhorses. And whatever it ends up being, it might be an inch, it might be 7/8, it might be 15/16, whatever it ends up being. And I'll just leave it there until I'm ready to actually make my piece and do the joinery and cut that stuff down to size. And then I'll go ahead and mill it, and then I'll use it right away. Mill it again.
Do you skip plane it when you first get it?
I've always used the joiner.
So do you just do the full 8-foot length?
No, I'm gonna pull a lot of the parts from it, as long as the parts under like you know, 8 or 9 inches.
Yeah, cross cut to rough length.
So I've got boards that are, you know, a couple three, four foot long, unless I have to have long boards. You know, that's a different story. But in most cases, most of the stuff I'm using, except for a tabletop, is going to be under 60 inches.
Yeah, I normally sticker after the initial milling, but I think I'm going to try your method, Guy, of just keeping it on the edge, storing it on the edge after the initial
and
milling.
If it warps a little bit, it doesn't matter because I'm going to go through the process again. It's going to cup a little bit, no matter what you do, or twist or whatever, you know, especially maple. Ugh. Don't even get me started.
Yeah, I'm not used very much of maple, but I can tell you how I handle tear out on the planers. I just have to run everything through the drum sander.
So I think we're going to rotate back to you, Sean. You have another question for us?
Yeah, let's talk about gluing up thin panels. So obviously on this bar stool project again, I did a lot of bent lamination, more than I wanted to, for the seats and the backrest, which meant that I had to glue up a lot of thin panels. So I got a question of how do I, for panels that are 1/4 inch or thinner, how do I glue them up? Now I've seen several people, do it this way, and Philip Morley
got that.
But I pretty much do it the same way. I used blue tip.
I'm older than he is. I've been doing it longer.
Oh, he did.
I can't remember where I saw that. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's super handy. So to begin, I guess for quarter inch panels or smaller or thinner, of course, putting them in parallel clamps is a pain in the butt because sometimes if you put enough pressure, they'll buckle in the clamps. So what I do is I make sure that the boards are nicely jointed, lay them on a flat surface, make sure that they go together well, and there's no gaps or anything, just to make sure it's a nice tight joint. And then what I'll do with the panels laying on their back is I'll put three pieces of tape perpendicular to the jointed edges. And then I'll do another piece of tape from the top to the bottom over top of the edge. And it's pretty much like if you've done any veneer glue ups where you use the veneer tape, you'll do a few pieces across and then one long piece on top. So I'll do that on the back side with the blue tape. And then I'll flip it over, fold the pieces up like a book, put the glue between the edges, rub it in there with my fingers, make sure it's nice, got nice coverage. And then I'll put it back down on the surface laying flat. And then I'll clean out the glue squeeze out. And then I'll put three pieces of tape again, perpendicular, and then one long piece over the glue joint. And then I'll just set it to the side and until it dries for about a couple of hours. And if for some reason there is something that I need to remove, I'll just run it through the drum sander, some glue line or something. But typically I get pretty flat panels doing it that way. But that's my method for gluing up thin panels. And Guy, I know that's how you probably do it as well, since I've seen you do it like that. But Hui, what about you? How do you glue up thin panels?
Well, Sean, I can actually legitimately say that I learned how to do thin panel glue up from Guy Dunlop, because I actually watched his videos on how he did it. Yeah, I do the same thing.
I've mixed both.
Yeah, I do the same thing. It's blue painter's tape, perpendicular, and then going lengthwise. Really doesn't require a lot of glue. It doesn't a lot. Once that glue tacks up, man, it's going to stay, and it stays flat.
It's a quarter inch panel or 3/8 of an inch panel. It's going to be captured inside a frame. It's not going to see any pressure. It's just got to be stuck right together. So, you know, the key to all this, I learned this the hard way, is that you have to have a dead flat assembly table for this to work. I've done it a couple times where I didn't know it because of where I positioned my assembly table. It was flat in one spot, but it flexed and I had a twist in it. And you really couldn't see it. You know, with winding sticks is how I found it. I'm like, oh, that's why my panels aren't flat. And I'd put that stuff in there and they'd be off. And I'm like, what the heck? They're not flat. So, you know, that you've got to have a dead flat surface. And, you know, if you don't have a dead flat surface like an assembly table, just use your top of your table saw. You know, that's just throw some wax paper down on it and put it right on top there. I don't bother with the tape going lengthwise. I just put three or four pieces across and that's it. And I typically only do one side. I don't bend it and book it to like a book and do what you're talking about, Sean, and put it down the seams. I just slap some glue on there, give it a rub joint, stick it down on my assembly table, which is wax, so it won't stick to it anyways. Put the tape across and move it to the side.
So, Guy, if you don't mind explaining, because I think maybe some folks don't know what a rub joint is. What exactly are you doing? Like, why is it called a rub joint? Like, what's happening there?
Well, the rub joint is exactly what it sounds like. I'm just going to put some glue on one side or both sides of the surfaces I want to put together, and I'm going to move them back and forth or rub the two pieces of wood together. First of all, it's going to make sure that I have even dispersal of the glue all the way through. Plus, if the boards are jointed properly, it actually acts as like a suction. So then I can just take the tape, and blue painter's tape is nice. I use a lot in veneering because it stretches. So I can put my thumb down on it, stretch it real tight across the joint, flatten it out, and I get good glue squeeze out. And like I said, I really don't care if there's any glue underneath it because my assembly table is waxed. It'll just come right up. And I just, like I said, I just move it off to the side. I'm done.
Yeah. And I've had someone ask me, is that strong enough? You know, is it a strong enough glue joint? And yeah, and I have the bent lamination seats to prove that, because they are all done the same exact way, because you got to rotate each panel. And you know, there's no gaps. It didn't crack. It didn't break. The glue lines are still held together.
How thick were the plies for that?
They were roughly right around 3/16 of an inch.
It's pretty thick.
Yep. Worked out fine. I did have a little bit of spring back, just a touch, using the plastic resin glue, but not much. But yeah.
How long did you keep it in the bag?
Roughly 12 hours. It's probably because
it was warm enough in there. Yeah.
It's probably because the panels were pretty thick, you know, 3/16. But
yeah,
at this point, this was my fourth seat bottom, and you know, it worked out. Now they were all the same. Three ply bent lamination seat in the backrest. So it worked out well. It did have a little bit of spring back, and I could probably do better by more plies and thinner plies, but I need a new bandsaw, and I was ready to move on. So the three ply, close to 5/8 of an inch thick, and it's good enough.
The advantage with going, we talked about this on the phone when you called that day, Sean, the more plies you have means the more glue you have.
Yep.
So, you know, especially with, but that was a really gentle bend.
Oh, absolutely.
It wasn't drastic, you know, half circle or anything.
Yeah.
So, but even then, having more plies just gives you more glue surface. And when you're using that plastic resin glue, that stuff dries like rock hard, and you get, you know, I always go by 5 plies minimum.
Yeah.
It's always got to be an odd number, because you have to have one in the middle and then you have one in each side. So a minimum of 3. And then five or seven for me is the magic number. It depends on how thick I'm going.
Yeah. But, you know, that, I mean, I learned my lesson on the plastic resin glue, because I used the mesh on the inside of the bag. Without putting like a plywood caul over the piece, and it stuck to that glue. Wow, it was a mess.
Yeah, I put a caul over everything now. I don't rely on the vacuum net anymore.
Oh, I've learned to do the same.
You put packing tape over the cauls as well?
I do, yes.
Guy?
And then I'll wax the edges.
I just wax them. I just put wax on it, yeah. And I use hardboard for my calls. I don't use 3/4 inch MDF or anything like that.
Yeah, the same here. I use hardboard.
And Guy, thanks for the tip on using the, what was it, 1/8 inch or 3/16 inch hardboard. That stuff
it's
a whole lot cheaper and better than the 1/8 inch ply that I was using.
It's beastie, man. It won't bend.
Great tip.
It won't bend. So
yeah, absolutely. That was a great tip.
So I glossed over Hui before.
That's so. All right. It's all right.
We'll let you go next week. What do you got for us?
All right. So I've been working. I just finished a miter saw station for a new miter saw that I got. And I had a question from...
You got a Festool Capex, didn't you?
I did. I said that's the a, F word. You said the F word.
Is that F word Festool or fence?
Let's not go there. So I had one of my followers actually ask me what the reasoning was for making the miter saw station as tall as it is. He mentioned that it just seems so much taller than my assembly table and my workbench and all the other work surfaces that I had on there. And it really came down to what I was comfortable with. This miter saw station is the same height as my old miter saw station, and I chose 42 inches, which is a standard height for a bar top. I'm approximately 5'7" on a good day, and
if you're wearing heels,
if I'm wearing heels, pumps, and at 42 inches, that puts the cabinet top right at my belly button, and that allows my arms to be positioned at a perfectly 90 degree to the work surface. And so that means I'm not reaching down to mark or move my workpiece, and I'm not reaching up. And that's it's also the perfect height for me to use my right eye, which is my dominant eye, to be able to sight down the cut line. again, without having to like sort of crouch down or to look up. So it really, the height of your work surfaces really is dependent on you, your stature and how tall you are, and what you're comfortable with. I mean, Guy, where does your miter saw station come
what's
up to?
What's the height of it?
Yeah. Maybe not specifically, but where on you?
If you can see me, which you can't because we're, you know, talking over this thing. It's about this high.
Well, that is extremely high.
I have no idea how tall it is. It was built, the stand that it's built on has got like a built-in shop vac with a dust deputy and a dustbin. And it was engineered from the inside out. So it was tall enough to accommodate all that stuff. If I had to guess, it's probably about 34 inches, give or take. It's probably around 34 to 35 inches because it's about the same height as my assembly table and table saw. I would have taken that in consideration too. I built it a couple of years ago, so I really don't remember. But I'd say 35 inches, give or take an inch.
And Sean, what do you have a miter station, right? Where you put your miter
saw? Yeah, I do. It is, my miter saw station is a last second thought process type deal where I was like, okay, I got a miter saw. I've got this moving cart. Let me throw some plywood and legs to the right of the cart and stick it out there. I don't have a proper miter saw station in my, well, I'll save that for another topic, but mine's about 32 inches. It's really low because I don't like having to reach high to pull the miter saw down over and over and over. So mine's right around 32 inches, but my ultimate goal is to just get rid of the miter saw in the shop, probably totally. But yeah, that mine's roughly 32 inches.
See, if you had a Festool Capex, you would love your miter saw.
I don't think I would. All I do is use it for breaking down rough stock, and then I use the table saw for all of the finish cuts.
I tell you what, man, that will give you furniture quality cuts. Perfectly 90. I can make picture frames all day with that thing set at 45 and have nothing but confidence. I have never had a miter saw, and I've gone through a few of them that doesn't deflect some way, shape, or form. That one does not deflect. Mm-hmm. Every cut is accurate.
Yeah. I mean, if Festool wanted to send me one, yeah, I would love to try it. But to be honest with you, I would like to reclaim some of that space in my shop because my ultimate goal is to remove the miter saw, remove that cart that's in there against the wall, do a flip top tool stand for the other things and reclaim that spot because I only use it to break down rough lumber.
Again, I'm not going to derail the question, but it's kind of in the same general category. When I was shop, before I bought my Grizzly bandsaw that I had, I went and looked at a lot of different bandsaws. And one thing I noticed, especially on the Lagunas, is that the tables on these things are just too low. I mean, they were like at the inseam of my pants, low.
Wow.
It was just, I'd have to be bending over all the time. I'm not tall. I'm like 6'1", a little bit north of 6'1", but not much. And to bend over like that all the time would just drive me crazy.
Yeah, it puts a lot of strain on your back.
Yeah, the Lagunas were just, it may be a great bandsaw. I'm looking, I'm not going to buy this thing. It's the table's 6 inches too low for me. The Grizzly was nice. That was a good bandsaw. The height was perfect on it. My Powermatic, the height is really good on it. And I've looked at the Jets too. I haven't seen that new 14-inch one, but I know like the 16 and the 18-inch ones, the tables are fairly high. So I know you're looking for a bandsaw. Take that in consideration, Sean. Go look at a Laguna before you decide that you want a Laguna because the tables are really low.
Yeah.
Really low.
I think right now I'm leaning toward the Jet 15-inch 3-horsepower, but I'm not 100%. All I know is that the Porter cable that I have, I mean, I've stretched the dollar that I've gotten out of that thing because, you know, it's just not made for the heavy-duty resawing of 12-inch wide boards, and it's just I got my money's worth. It's time to sell it to someone else that wants to do some lighter work with it and get something a little more that has more power and heavy-duty.
I think that's something that we often overlook, though, is, I mean, I'll be honest, when I bought my bandsaw, which was the same bandsaw that you have, Guy, it usually came down to money, right? Mm-hmm. And not necessarily ergonomics. And I'm slowly but surely learning that ergonomics, sometimes it's worth the extra money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, it's, if you're going to be out there all day like I am, I mean, the less you have, especially at my age, the less you have to bend over, the better you are.
Plus it's safer.
I mean, I want, well, it's not only that, but it's not just using your arms and bending over. It's my eyesight. You know, I used to laugh a long time ago when I'd look at the, you know, Rockler catalogs, like, well, they got all this stuff in here for people that can't see. And now I'm in that situation. I can't see anything anymore. I got to move my glasses off my head and get in there real close. And it's kind of a pain in the butt. But, you know, you got to take all that in consideration. So I think I have the last question here. And this is a question you guys probably know him from YouTube, from Mac, MRW Mac. Mac's been with me a long time, kind of like you, Hui. So he comments just about every video I do. He's an awesome dude. Anyways, so one of the projects I built, not this last one, the one before that, I built a demi-lune table. And for the substrate, it's all veneer work. And for the substrate, I used MDF. So he's asking, he says, you're using MDF as the base or backer. My experience is that MDF doesn't screw into very well. But since you and I don't use much hardware, I guess it doesn't matter. But if you need to screw into the MDF, does pre-drilling do well enough? And is it strong enough for your projects? Mac, you're absolutely correct. MDF does not hold screws very well. That being said, for a tabletop, especially for veneer, you have a choice of whether you're going to use like a Baltic birch, which is like a 9-ply veneer that has no voids, or MDF. I much prefer to use MDF as a substrate. It's notoriously flat. It holds glue very well. It doesn't warp and twist as much. And it's just an infinitely cheaper, easier material to work with. All that being said, it does not take screws very well. So I've always pre-drilled into the MDF. And then you just have to be really careful putting the screws in. I usually use just a regular screwdriver. I don't use power tools when putting the screws in. I just snug them up till I'm getting a good amount of resistance on it, and I stop. And as long as you don't pull that screw in and out a bunch of times, it should be strong enough for a small tabletop. Now, if I'm building a larger tabletop and I'm going to make it out of MDF, typically what I'm going to do is I'm going to frame that in solid wood, which you can do with veneer because it's not the feel of the table isn't going to expand and contract like a solid wood top. So I'll typically frame it. And I'll make that frame big enough so where it's solid wood, I know that's where I'm going to screw in to attach it to the aprons, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or I'll engineer something into the top to compensate for where I'm going to put those screws in to hold it. That's my two cents on it. If it were up to me, I'd use Baltic birch for everything, but it's expensive. I have to run out and get it, and I have to go to, you know, the closest place I can get Baltic birch is Rockler, which is about 20 minutes away. And it's prices are decent at Rockler, but it's not the cheapest thing in the world. I can just go to Home Depot and get a sheet of MDF for, you know, $25.
Yeah. It's cheaper to have MDF on hand than Baltic birch.
Yeah. I go through a ton of MDF. I use MDF for everything, man.
It's just so heavy.
Yeah, it is. One thing that I have done with larger field MDF pieces that are veneered is use brass threaded inserts, and then I'll epoxy those in. That's definitely not necessary, but it's sort of a foolproof way of ensuring that I'm not an idiot and strip out the screws.
Yeah, you can do that too. But I mean, if you're putting enough pressure to rip out a screw, you can put enough pressure on the MDF to rip out those plugs too. MDF is very brittle. And, you know, for small tables, like that thing, you know, it's just a, the table itself was, you know, it's half a circle, you know, it's demi-lune or half moon. So it's half a circle and it's 24 inches wide and 12 inches deep. You know, there's
not very heavy.
It was getting, it's not very heavy at all. And it was just going up against the wall. There was no legs to it or anything. I just drilled it right into the apron, right into the studs of the wall. So, it was fine for doing that.
Yeah. Just know your limits on what material to use and
yeah.
Or learn the hard way. Like I've done plenty of times.
Oh, I've done myself. Believe me.
We all have. But all right. Well, I guess that's it. You know, I think that's going to do it for the show. I just want everybody listening, you know, thank you for sticking with us this long through our first episode. I hope that, you know, over time we'll get a little bit better with this. And remember that this podcast is here to answer your questions. So if you have questions you'd like answered, you can send them to us through the podcast contact page at Woodshop Life Podcast, or DM us through Instagram at Woodshop Life. And you can reach me at Guy's Woodshop. And where can you be found at, Hui?
I can be found at alabamawoodworker.com or my Instagram page at alabamawoodworker. I would say my YouTube page, but I haven't made a video in quite a while. I got a new baby, so hopefully one of these days I'll get back onto the YouTube. How about you, Sean?
You can find me at instagram.com/SimpleCove on YouTube, Facebook, as well as SimpleCove.com.
All right. Well, great. We will talk to you later, guys.
Yeah, great talking to you.
See you guys later.